All right, here we go. This is Didactic Mind, episode 25, Expert Stupidity. A very warm welcome, as always, to all of my readers, all of my SoundCloud followers, subscribers, and everyone from the blog. Very warm welcome to all of you. It's a great pleasure to have you back, as always. Today, I want to start by offering Easter greetings to my Orthodox listeners. Last week was Easter for those of us who stick to the Gregorian calendar, and for those of us who stick to the Julian calendar, which is pretty much the entirety of the Orthodox Church, and that would include pretty much all of the Slavic-speaking peoples. Today is Easter, 1 week later. Don't ask me why the calendars are so radically different. It has to do with the differences in dating conventions and the fact that one follows the cycles of the moon and the other follows the cycles of the sun and so on and so forth. But the important thing is that no matter who you are, no matter which tradition you follow, all that matters is that you bend the knee and proclaim Jesus Christ as Lord. That you are willing to say with your voice and with your heart that you believe in God the Father of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And as long as you're willing to say that, as long as you're willing to articulate this and confess Jesus as Lord, you're in a pretty good place, because no matter what else you do wrong in your life, you'll always have that advocate before the Lord, Jesus himself, standing before God the Father, advocating on your behalf, asking him for forgiveness for you. And the older you get, the closer you get to meeting your Maker, the more important that becomes. Because all of us, even the most devout Christians, will always fall off the hard and narrow path. We're always going to sin, we're always going to do bad things, we're always going to grow impatient with stupidity, we're always going to treat people badly, and we're always going to break the primary commandments, the most important of which is love God with all your heart, love your neighbor as you love yourself, and do not murder, do not adulter, do not bear false witnesses. I won't go into the theology of it all about whether the Bible says do not lie, because that's not quite true. What the Bible actually says is do not bear false witness against your neighbor. There are times when I think even the most abstract theologians would admit there are times when telling lies may be necessary to preserve greater truths. Now, I don't know what many of you would say to that. I'm sure a lot of you will disagree. I would simply say that there are times when, at least in matters not related to God, who is truth, it is necessary to preserve certain polite fictions. If you think about it carefully, the very concept of civilization itself is basically a polite fiction. It's a polite fiction that we use to stop millions upon millions of us dying off like flies from living in close proximity to each other. Civilization is essentially a polite fiction, a veneer placed over the inner nature of all of us, the savagery that each of us is capable of committing in order to make sure that we can live side by side, more or less in peace. But getting a little bit off topic there. As I was saying, I do want to wish my Orthodox brethren a very happy Easter. The traditional greeting for those of you who understand or speak some Russian is, of course, Christos Voskres. And for those, again, who speak Russian, Bog s nami, God is with us. So Christ is risen and God is with us. And don't ever forget that, especially during these very dark, very troubled times. And it is precisely that topic of these dark and troubled times that brings me to today's podcast. I have referenced this in previous podcasts, and I've explicated it in various ways. But what is becoming inarguably clear at this point is that the predictions of the experts have been so spectacularly wrong and so profoundly stupid that one of the good things, in my opinion, that will come out of this crisis is a deep distrust and deep lack of faith in expert opinion. And that's a very, very good thing. For too long, we have allowed so-called experts to get away with telling us what to think and how to live and what to do. This was a huge mistake on all of our parts because we basically surrendered our ability to think and to reason in favor of expert opinion that really is not expert at all. Now, to get an understanding of just what a dumb decision this was, all you have to do is look at the epidemiological, virological models that we keep being presented with in the face of the ongoing pandemic. Now, we know that the COVID-19 virus, as it is in its current form, has a very high probability of being a lab-created construct. That's not a conspiracy theory. That sounds crazy. I am well aware of that. But the more that we look into the evidence, the more that it becomes clear that this virus was a construct. The mainstream media, the lying hornalists of the media, don't want you to know this. They don't want you to think this because the implications are absolutely horrifying. They are mind-bending. I mean, if this virus was created in a lab and it got out, God help us all, and God help the Chinese for what the Chi-Coms have done. Expert opinion tells us, no, this can't, you know, the credentialed experts around the world say, no, this is not a created virus at all. This is, you know, it's a natural construct. Oh, really? Okay. Well, expert opinion would have you believe that this virus is a completely natural, zoonotically transmitted double-strand RNA virus. All right. Now, I'm not an expert in biology. I am not an expert in biochemistry. My background is in mathematics and in finance. Okay. I'm a programmer. I'm a mathematician, an extremely bad one. I'm a problem solver. I understand how to examine financial statements and look at financial models. Okay, that's my area of expertise. I don't know anything much beyond that, you know, in most areas. What I do know is based on what I've gleaned over the years, over many things that I've read, seen, absorbed. So I don't understand the full process of how viruses interact and spread. Okay, I don't pretend to. What I do understand is probabilities. And when I see that COVID-19 has an 88% genomic match with two other bat coronaviruses, and only a 79% genomic match with the original SARS, even though COVID-19 has been touted as a direct descendant of SARS by the experts, then I know that something's off. When I see that in the DNA, and in the, not DNA, in the genome profile of COVID-19, the S protein, or the spike protein, of the coronavirus itself, has an exact match, basically, with the same S protein in SARS, which is a human-to-human virus, that can't be coincidental. It cannot be the case that you have a virus which is much more similar to another bat-derived virus, and yet has the same spike protein as a human virus. that cannot be coincidental. Okay, that's just the probabilities are so ridiculously small, it can't be a coincidence. Now, in the there was a post that I put up earlier this week concerning, it's called the CCP virus, concerning research into the subject of whether or not COVID-19 was artificially lab-created. The evidence that we have, the latest genetic research that we have, indicates that it absolutely was. Now, the people interviewed for that documentary are a pretty interesting bunch. One of them is Dr. Judy A. Mikovits, or whatever her name is. She is a very famous researcher. I had no idea who she was until I found her name in connection with another sort of long rant that another very, very well-credentialed expert gave on the Next News Network. One of my readers, a friend of mine, he sent me this video and I watched the whole way through. It's like 45 minutes long and it's kind of hard to take because it's just this one guy ranting on and on and on about all sorts of weird stuff. And some of the implications that he comes up with are horrifying. I mean, the way he talks, he's very passionate, he's very fired up. But for people like me, he turns me off because I just find such polemics to be, absent of analysis and reason. I don't see them as being as containing that much by way of factual information that I can actually chew on. This guy makes the assertion in the video, and I'll include that video in the description box so you can go check it out for yourself, see what you think of it. It is by a chap named, let me go look up my YouTube history. It is by a chap named Dr. Rashid Buttar, and he's a very, very highly qualified medical expert. I mean, he's got a list of qualifications as long as my arm. He's talking about how COVID-19 is a manufactured virus. And in the process of making his points, he basically makes the assertion, there are so many studies out there which show that if you have the flu vaccine, particularly the, there's a term he used about something about a triple something flu vaccine, triple coated, I think it was, flu vaccine, then you will test positive for COVID-19. You are much more likely to test positive. So people who have flu vaccine, who have been vaccinated for the flu, will show up as COVID-19 positive. That sounded like nonsense to me. So I went and looked it up. The assertion, apparently, again, this is what the USA Today has to say on the subject. So, I believe them about as much as I believe the mouth of Sauron. Or about as much as I believe CNN lol, which is basically the same thing at this point. Pretty much everything they say is a lie, so you can just ignore them, or the BBC for that matter. But the USA Today pointed out that this assertion came from a small study done in Hong Kong back in 2008, so over 10 years ago, concerning SARS patients, or I should say concerning people infected with coronaviruses who had already had flu vaccinations. So the methodology was dubious at best. Now, factor in the reality that most, at least half of all scientific research these days is extremely suspect and cannot be reproduced, particularly in fields like biology and psychology. In these fields, a lot of what is passed off as research, quote-unquote, these days, cannot be reproduced, okay? So the experts are basing their opinions on things that cannot be tested, cannot be reproduced, cannot be modeled, and are coming up with opinions based on very bad data. And this is a theme that we have seen pop up over and over and over again during this crisis. The experts keep telling us that this COVID-19 virus is a natural zoonotic mutation, meaning that it started with bats, it was transmitted to pangolins, pangolins, and then it was transmitted to humans via basically a wet market, the Huanan seafood market in Wuhan, in Hubei province in China. Okay, that's the expert opinion. But the expert opinion turns out is wrong, because the initial studies done into coronavirus transmission, as published in quite prestigious medical journals around the world, have shown that of 41 patients tested for COVID-19, 14 of them had absolutely nothing to do with the Huanan seafood market. So that alone, the fact that one-third of a sample set did not test positive, or one-third of a sample set had nothing to do with the supposed origin of the virus, indicates that there's something seriously wrong with the narrative. And yet the experts maintain the narrative. It is to our enormous good fortune, and I genuinely and absolutely sincerely mean that, it is our enormous good fortune that we have someone like His Most Illustrious, Noble, August, Benevolent, and Legendary Celestial Majesty, the God Emperor of Mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, may the Lord bless him and preserve him, in charge of the United States of America right now. With him as Commander-in-Chief, a lot of things that were once dismissed as crazy speculation are now things that people are talking about. Why? Because he, as far as I can tell, looks for the truth and doesn't really trust the experts either. And that's a very, very good thing. That's a very wonderful thing, because the experts are the ones who have gotten us into this whole mess in the first place. The experts were the ones who originally said, this virus is not particularly dangerous. This virus is no more dangerous than the average seasonal flu. This virus is easily contained. Okay, that turned out to be wrong. Now the experts are saying, this virus was a natural creation. This virus requires a complete shutdown of the economy until 2022. This virus cannot be easily stopped. This virus is extraordinarily dangerous to everybody. This virus has a 5% mortality rate. Every single one of those claims is provably false. We now know that COVID-19 has a mortality rate, a true mortality rate, several times greater than that of a regular flu, but it's certainly not 5%. It's probably not even 1% at this point. We now have enough evidence in front of us to indicate that whatever the total sample size is of people who have tested positive for COVID-19, the true number of people who are infected with it is anywhere from 5 to 7 times greater than that. Which means that if 1% of people who contract COVID-19, or I should say, if 5% of people who, you know, supposedly contract COVID-19 die, then you have to divide that by 5 to 7 to get something like the true mortality rate of this virus. This is the case repeatedly around the world, where we have seen time and time and time and time and time again that the initial estimates of how many people were dying from COVID-19 were wildly inaccurate. And they're still wildly inaccurate now. Why? Because there is no universally agreed upon methodology to figure out how to compute those who died from COVID-19. How do you count people who died from it? Expert opinion keeps telling us that we need to put people on ventilators to stop them from dying from this virus. Well, actually, the latest clinical data coming out of the viral hotspots in Italy, in New York, and in other places, tell us that if you're put on a ventilator, if you're in China, the death rate from people being put on ventilators was like 2/3. The death rate from people being put on ventilators in London, you know, within the NHS, is about 80%. That's a similar death rate to what we're seeing in New York as well. Meaning that if you have COVID-19, if you have the Kung flu, if you have the Chink flu, if you have the Wuhan virus, if you have the CCP virus, and I'm using these terms very deliberately, I am deliberately putting the blame exactly where it belongs, upon the Chinese people and the Chinese government for what they have done to the world. If you catch the Kung flu and you get to the critical stage where, you know, both lungs are affected and you're in severe respiratory distress, and you get put on a ventilator, your odds of making it out are 1 in 3 or less. Your odds, let me repeat that. Once you get put on a ventilator, your odds of survival are 1 in 3 or less, according to the data that we have. This is actual data. This is not model projections. This is not expert opinion. This is actual data that we have in front of us. So why the hell are we putting so many people on ventilators? Ventilators are used for true respiratory emergencies. There was a doctor in New York who basically stated the opinion based on, you know, what he was seeing, that there is simply no justification for putting most people on ventilators, and that if you put people on these ventilators, then you've got a serious problem. The ventilators are not the cure-all that people think they are. They're actually really dangerous to most people. Why is that? Why is it that people are misusing ventilators? Because people are misdiagnosing the nature of this virus. Where was it? I remember reading an article about this from, I think, Sarah Vine, about this on the Daily Mail. But basically, one of the doctors on the front lines treating this virus was saying, we're looking at it the wrong way. We're trying to say that this is the same as pneumonia. It's not. When pneumonia attacks the lungs, it only typically attacks one lung at a time. With COVID-19, you see pneumonia-like symptoms, but it's not pneumonia. Both lungs are affected. Both lungs are damaged. So why are we putting people on ventilators when the data that we have show us that putting oxygen in people's bloodstreams through simple oxygenation masks would be much safer, much more effective, much less traumatic, much less dangerous to the patient's health? Why aren't we doing that? Now, experts would have you think that this is crazy, that we need lots of ventilators. But that hasn't been the case. The expert opinions told us that at the peak of the crisis in New York City, 140,000 beds would be needed, 140,000 hospital beds, and 40,000 ventilators would be needed. You know how many hospitalizations occurred in New York at the peak of their death toll? About 9,000. Okay, so where did this 140,000 number come from? Well, it came from horrendously stupid and terrible projections from mathematical models that had garbage assumptions in them. And this is where I keep coming back to, again, the ignorance of the experts, the stupidity of the experts. Experts may be very, very well credentialed in one field, but they're completely blind in other fields. And this is what makes specialization of knowledge so dangerous. If you know and understand how a mathematical model or distribution works, that's a good thing, but you have to understand where it applies and what the assumptions are behind it. And I'll give you a very concrete example from my own background in mathematical finance. In mathematical finance, there is a concept known as value at risk. Value at risk is best summed up as a mathematical way of expressing the statement of how bad things could get. You know, a value at risk number, a VAR number, basically says I am X percent confident that we will lose no more than Y dollars over the next N days. Okay, so typically that's expressed at a 95% confidence level, meaning I am 95% confident that we will lose no more than $1 billion over the next 3 days. That's a typical time horizon. It's a 3-day VAR. Most banks calculate a 1-day VAR, a 3-day VAR, and a 10-day VAR. The way that these numbers are calculated depends on the particular bank and the particular risk management desk. Most banks typically use a historical simulation method, which means that they look at up to 3 years and sometimes up to 10 years of data. of financial data, of like stock market returns or price histories for particular instruments. And they will then apply some very simple non-parametric, meaning, you know, not, they don't assume a particular distribution of the data. They just say that we're going to look at the returns over the last, let's say, 3 years, and we're going to pick the 10 worst, or, you know, the 5% worst returns from that sample set. So if you have 1,000 data points, you take basically the 50 worst returns from those data points, the 50 worst scenarios, and you then apply those 50 worst scenarios to the current value of your portfolio, and you therefore get a one-day projection for how bad, you know, things could be. And from those 50 worst scenarios, you take the least worst, if you will, and that is your one-day 5% VAR. So that basically says, you know, I am 95% confident that we will lose no more than $1 billion in the next 3 days or in the next 1 day or whatever. Sounds great, right? It sounds like a really brilliant idea, except it's failed so many times it's not even funny. I can tell you from personal experience, value at risk has absolutely no value whatsoever when things are actually at risk. Because when a desk blows up or when something really goes wrong, people come along and they're like, why didn't our VAR model predict that? And they look at the VAR models and like, oh, hang on a second. Our VAR model said our, you know, daily returns were, like our losses were well in line with expectations. And yet the desk lost $100 million over the last 6 months. What are we supposed to do? I'm not making this up. I used to be affiliated with, I actually used to run the product control team in some ways. Like, I wasn't the actual team leader, but I was basically the point man for the exotics finance team at a big bank, working with their inflation and index-linked derivatives products, okay? I know what I'm talking about because I was there on the front lines every single day for 2 years, year and a half, doing the actual P&L and risk management for that book. When I say risk management, I would calculate the actual risk and I would send it downstream to the risk management teams, and they would assess whether or not it was in line with their VAR models. Now, I was there, I was managing the inflation book as the product controller during the time when the inflation business was making huge amounts of money, and it was making that money because the trader in question really knew what he was doing. He was very skilled and he did a lot of really good deals, and he always managed somehow to come in under his price testing limits. So what that means is that he was always able to price his trades in such a way that they were well in line with what the market consensus was for what is an appropriate price for this deal. And yet, he was always able to make much more money over much more volume than any of the other big banks. Barclays couldn't match him, Goldman couldn't match him, JP Morgan couldn't match him, Credit Suisse couldn't match him. No one else had the range and the risk management skill that he did. And the inflation business at that particular bank was the number one on the street. Okay, it was the number one on all of Wall Street for investment banking. And, you know, he was doing deals with investment banks for hedging out his book, and he was doing big deals with hedge funds and private investors. Well, not private investors, but basically hedge funds for his strategic positions. So he had such a good grasp of risk management that he never really lost particular amounts of money. And he was making $30 million, $40 million, $50 million every single year that he was there. Then he left and went to another bank. Now, $40 million, $50 million doesn't really sound like a whole lot of money when you're talking about businesses with hundreds of billions of dollars worth of balance sheet. This business had $4 billion worth of balance sheet. $50 million in 1 year is tremendous. That's an amazing accomplishment with such a small balance sheet. He somehow managed to make it work. Then he left, and the business was left in the hands of a junior trader who really got the shit end of the stick, I'm sorry to say. I knew the guy. He's a good guy. Nice guy. You know, very young, very nerdy kind of guy, but really not, didn't have the constitution to be a trader. He didn't understand how all the models worked. He didn't understand, you know, how his predecessor had done what he did. And he basically tried to keep things stable. So he did not remark his volatilities. He did not change his inputs, his most critical pricing parameter, actually, for his options. And if you know anything about option trading, you know that implied volatility, when you plug it into your option price, is by far the most important input. He didn't change that for many months after his predecessor left. And then, all of a sudden, when the markets changed in the inflation business, the book began to lose millions upon millions of dollars very, very quickly. And all of a sudden, the price testing inputs went haywire. And all of a sudden, the risk management metrics went haywire. And people were like, what the hell's going on? This, by the way, was a couple of years after I had left. After I had left that particular business. So whatever happened there, you know, I had nothing to do with it. This was years after I had handed over the business to somebody else. This was years after the team had changed. The trader had moved on a year before all this went on. So bottom line is, whatever happened, you know, it was well out of anybody else's hands who had been there at the time. So this book kept losing money, kept losing money, kept losing money. And the risk management team was like, hey, our experts tell us this model is doing fine. The reason why the model was doing fine was because the assumptions of that model had never been tested. Nobody had thought to test the assumption of whether or not the trader is remarking his volatilities appropriately. Guess what? That assumption proved to be wrong. The book lost something like $60 million in the space of a month. So, and then it lost some more money, you know, another $40 million, when the head of U.S. Fixed income at the time, basically, or actually it was global fixed income eventually, a chap named Sam Wisnia. And it's perfectly fine for me to say his name, you know, in public, because he's quite notorious in the industry. He long since moved on from that bank to another, you know, to another private partnership. Sam Wisnia was the global head of rates at the time, and he sent in a team of very skilled quants to go and investigate what the hell had happened with this book. They came in. And they examined quite in considerable detail. They examined forensically what was going on with all of the data. And they realized very quickly that the junior trader at the time had not changed his volatility inputs at all. They had to suspend the trader. He was put on indefinite leave. And then he was eventually let go very quietly. He was fired. At this point, the book had lost about $100 million in total. The next year, they started afresh with a new trader and a new junior guy. The new head trader, I've never met him. I have no idea what he's like. I don't know his name. No, I do know his name, but I just don't remember it. He came in and he took a bunch of big positions in the market because he expected inflation to spike up significantly. And this was back in sort of 2017, right? 2017, which was right after his Celestial Majesty, the God Emperor, was elected. And there was a significant expectation that inflation would really spike up because the expectation was that with the God Emperor's package of big tax cuts, and therefore, you know, big fiscal stimulus and big monetary stimulus via the incorporation, if you will, or the onboarding of a new Federal Reserve chairman, inflationary monetary policy would be followed. So the trader at the time took this view that the markets would go big on inflation, that inflation numbers would ramp up to above 2%, and therefore he positioned his desk, his business, his trades, to take advantage of a big long-term rise in inflation. So he went really long inflation. Come about 6 to 8 months later, none of this has happened. None of the expectations have come to pass. Inflation remains muted somehow, and yet the economy is going gangbusters somehow. The traders' positions are all losing massive amounts of money because all of these options are, you know, big option positions are expiring out of the money, meaning that they are, their value is basically worthless. But if you trade options, you know that you trade, you actually have to pay a certain amount for an option. That's the premium that you pay. And your hope is, your bet is, that the option will pay off more than the premium that you paid for it. Because everybody was kind of looking the same way and saying, you know, this is where business is going to go, everybody was charging heavy premiums for long call options because they expected that these options would expire in the money, and therefore everybody would make a lot of money from it. So, you know, by definition, those options were very valuable because everybody wanted them. The desk proceeded to lose $10 million in the space of a single night. The VAR models never went off. They never registered it. The risk management teams were like, holy shit, what the hell happened? They looked back at their models and they realized, huh, nothing in the VAR models said this couldn't happen. This was all in line with the desk's VAR expectations. The VAR models never tested for whether or not the assumptions were correct. They never tested for whether or not the trader was using the right inputs, whether or not inflation data were correct in the way that they're put together, which they're not. I mean, we know inflation statistics, unemployment statistics, and GDP statistics are absolute flagrant bullshit. I mean, it's not even the Chinese who make up shit when it comes to GDP or inflation or unemployment. Everybody does it. Everybody just completely makes up crap when it comes to all of these things. Economic indicators are hopelessly inaccurate, but we have to trade on bad data to begin with, right? The experts were wrong again because they never tested their assumptions. They never tested whether or not they were right. Experts are incredibly stupid in a lot of areas, and they don't know it. I mean, I can give you an example from my own life about where I was really stupid and where I made a big mistake, a huge mistake, continues to cost me to this day. It's one that I wish I'd never made. When I lost my job 2 years ago, I kind of assumed that it would be easy to find another one, just like it was the two times before that I had lost my job. You know, I'd been let go from my first job in the US in November of 2009, I had been let go from my second job in the U.S. in August of 2011. Both times, I found a new job within a month. And I was able to come back to the U.S. and continue working, you know, pick up where I left off and just carry on. And I was fine. You know, everything worked out pretty well. This time, however, I had not counted on the fact that the God Emperor would very quickly set about making life very difficult for people who applied for H-1Bs. I agree with that policy, by the way. I completely support the American administration, the American government, making it much harder for foreigners to come to the USA and take American jobs, especially white-collar jobs. That's not only a correct policy, it's totally justified. The H-1B visa is a giant scam, and it really needs to be treated as a giant scam. The number of people who actually come to the U.S., and become, you know, essentially American patriots in the process, you know, through the process of getting an H-1B is tiny. I have family members right now who are looking to acquire an H-1B. They aren't American. They have no interest in staying in America long term, but they've got an American visa. And that's a job that could have been taken by an American, but it's not being used by an American. It's not going to an American. So I have a lot of sympathy for the point of view that, you know, the H-1B needs to be scrapped and replaced with a points-based system. Totally in favor of that. Actually, I'm more in favor of a complete moratorium on immigration to the extent that is practical and practicable, but that's a different story. The point here is that I made an assumption that turned out to be wrong, and I paid the price for it. I'm still paying the price for it, and I will probably pay the price for it for much of the rest of my life. Now, with respect to what got me started on all this rant, the assumptions behind COVID-19. We keep being told that COVID-19, again, is a zoonotic natural virus. It's not. The assumption behind zoonotic transmission is that a virus can jump easily from one species to another without significant structural changes to its genome. Like, really? No, that doesn't happen in real life. In real life, what typically happens is that you get mutations in the genome of a virus that change its structure, a little switch gets flipped on or off in the genomic pattern, which allows it to do things that it couldn't do before, or which breaks certain information. Now, that's what a mutation is. It's a genetic error. It's a propagation of an error in the genetic code. And usually most mutations get fixed pretty quickly. But for mutations to propagate through the family or through the genetic history of an organism, that mutation has to be successful. It has to be one that works to ensure an organism's survival. Now, if, think through it logically for a moment, if the spike protein from COVID-19 was successful at attaching to bats, to the cells found in bats, why would that make it successful in attaching to cells found in humans? It doesn't make any sense. Why would that be the case? Especially given that the bat viruses to which COVID-19 bears the most similarities come from a city that's 1,000 kilometers away to the east of Wuhan. How does that make any sense? How is it that bats found in a cave in Zhushan can travel all the way back to Wuhan, where there were no bats found in the actual Huanan seafood market, none whatsoever, and infect humans with the relative ease and virulence that COVID-19 has? Remember that SARS, which is the supposed predecessor of COVID-19, actually had a very hard time infecting people. It infected about 8,000 people worldwide and killed about 800 of them. But in reality, SARS was very hard to catch. This virus, on the other hand, transmits very, very easily. It has a much higher what's known as R0. Infection ratio. So if one person is infected, then he will typically infect anywhere between 1.5 and 2.5 other people. That's the R0 of this virus. There are other viruses which have much higher R0s, by the way. Measles, for instance, is extremely contagious, and that's like an R0 of 5. But COVID-19 has a much higher infectability, or is much more infectious than SARS, yet it has the same spike protein. Like, what? How does that work? More to the point, there was a paper published by an Indian medical team on BioRxiv online. Now, that paper has since been withdrawn because a lot of the comments strongly criticized its methodology and pointed out that genetic inserts into the code are not uncommon. It's quite common, in fact, to find surface proteins on viri that match, you know, among different viruses. So it's not unusual to find these things. It's not it may be sensationalist to claim that COVID-19's GP41 coat protein, which is basically identical to what is found in HIV. This is sensationalist to claim that. But if you go look up that paper, what you'll find is that the scientists were basically claiming there are four unique inserts into the genetic code of COVID-19, or there are four unusual inserts. The only viruses that have all four of these inserts are COVID-19, SARS, and HIV. Now, one of those inserts showing up at random in the code of in the genome for COVID-19, I could believe, I could buy that that's just coincidence. Two of them? Okay, hang on a second. Three of them? Whoa, that's not coincidence anymore. Four of them at the same time? All right, somebody's monkeying with someone at this point. There's a phrase in the military, I believe, once as happenstance, twice as coincidence, three times as enemy action. What's four times in a row? That's a puckering feeling in the seat of your pants, okay? That's a scary sign that something's going on that we don't quite understand. Now, we could all be wrong. It could very well be that COVID-19, that the Kung Flu was somehow created through zoonotic transmission. If so, then researchers need to prove it. They need to come up with a plausible explanation of how it jumped from one thing, one creature, to the next. They haven't been able to do that yet, because every time they've tried to come up with a reasonable zoonotic explanation, that's been proven wrong. We know that COVID-19 could not possibly have reasonably started from the Huanan seafood market. We know that COVID-19, the Kung Flu, has certain properties which appear to be bioengineered. We have evidence from too many different research papers and too many different laboratories around the world indicating that there's something really hinky going on with this virus. There's simply too many things lining up one after another. The experts have been wrong about that. The experts are wrong about the idea that COVID-19 is a naturally occurring phenomenon. The experts are wrong about the ways to contain this virus. All of the epidemiological models have operated on this assumption that you can basically completely shut down the economy, stop people from moving around, and therefore the virus will, the mortality rate will flatten out, and that you will extend out the total sort of time span required for the virus to take hold in a human population. Okay, that's true. This whole idea of flattening the curve is that's the theory behind this, the lockdown. The models used to predict the effects of curve flattening are so ridiculously off, it's actually insulting to the intelligence of an ordinary human being. The Imperial College of London model, promoted by Dr. Neil Ferguson, Professor Neil Ferguson, actually, predicted originally 2.2 million deaths without any action whatsoever in the USA, and about 500,000 deaths in the UK without any action whatsoever. And then those numbers were reduced down dramatically to like 200,000 in the US and 50,000 in the UK with significant strong action taken. Okay, significant strong action was taken. And the death rates are coming in way below what the actual models predicted. Why is that? Because the models are wrong. They use terrible assumptions and they use bad data to come up with ridiculous assertions about what could happen. Remember that flattening the curve does not mean reducing the death rate. It doesn't. Flattening the curve simply means extending out the period in which the virus will kill people. The only reason you do this is to stop people from, is to stop the sick from overwhelming hospitals. Well, hospitals haven't been overwhelmed. Even with extremely strong preventative measures, the hospital systems are barely being pushed. Even in New York City, where the emergency is the worst in all of the United States, hospital systems have not been crushed. They haven't been overburdened. The federal government, the God Emperor directed the USNS Mercy and Comfort to go to Los Angeles and New York, respectively, I believe. I could be wrong about which one went where. But that's essentially what happened. The two big Navy hospital ships with 1,000 beds went to each of these locations. At the peak of the crisis, you know how many hospital beds were used on the ship docked off of New York? 9. 9 out of 1,000. Like, come on, man. I mean, something is way off. These models are so ridiculously off. And yet we're putting our faith in these experts who keep telling us we need to shut down everything until the end of the year or until 2022. Like, come on. This is idiotic. Not only should we not listen to them, we should put them on trial for criminal malfeasance. Criminal malpractice, actually. Because hundreds of millions, if not billions of lives have been affected by people saying, we need to shut everything down. No, we don't. We don't need to shut everything down. We don't need to crash the entire global economy to prevent this virus from spreading. It's idiotic. It's unnecessary. The experts keep telling us that this is what we have to do. And in reality, all we have to do is ignore them. And we're going to be more or less okay. Is this an appropriate reaction for something like, let's say, bird flu? Oh, yeah. Yeah. If bird flu was able to jump, you know, if H5N1 was able to jump quickly from human to human, H5N1 has a fatality rate of 60%. 2 in 3 people who contract it will die. And they'll die horribly. They'll die because their lungs, the cells in their lungs will rupture. Fluid will start leaking out of these cell membranes, and they will basically drown in their own fluids. H5N1 will not kill you directly, not usually. That's not usually what happens. What typically happens is H5N1 will cause the fluid, will cause your lungs to fill with fluid, and then secondary infections are what get you, because your entire immune system is compromised trying to fight off this one virus. Your body is under tremendous load trying to fight it off. And then secondary infections get into your lungs, such as pneumonia and such as just regular common colds, you know, rhinovirus, get into your lungs. And that's what kills you, because now you don't have the ability to fight it off anymore. You drown in your own fluids, and you drown as your body goes into what is known as a cytokine storm. Essentially, it's your body's immune system going crazy. It overreacts. And basically tries to kill everything in sight. And the result is your own body kills you. In the event that the Chinese, and it will be the Chinese, because the Chinese are responsible for most of the pandemics that have occurred over the last, 100 years or so. If you look at the 1957 flu pandemic, which killed like 157,000 Americans, guess where that came from? Came from China. If you look at SARS, guess where that came from? Freaking China. If you look at COVID-19, well, I mean, we don't need any more evidence. The Chinese are responsible for this. There is no question that if H5N1 was on the loose in the world, telling everybody to stay at home, stay away from people, don't even so much as touch anyone else, that is sensible advice. Because when you're dealing with a death rate that is 2 in 3, that is good advice. But when you're dealing with a death rate that's less than 1% in reality and affects mostly people over the age of 60 with pre-existing health conditions and mostly disproportionately targets men, is this really something we should be freaking out about? Really? There's no reason to freak out about something that works the way that COVID-19 does, the way that the Kung Flu is doing things, the way that the chink flu is working. This is not anywhere near as grave an emergency as we think it is. What is an emergency is the fact that we're listening to experts tell us things which are proven to be wrong, repeatedly, constantly, totally wrong. We're listening to experts constantly telling us, you can't go outside, you can't gather in public places, you will spread this infection, we must drop everything and destroy the entire economy just to save grandma. Really? Why? Now, I'm not saying this callously, because I have parents in the risk range for COVID-19. My father was a smoker for like 50 years, almost 45 years out of those 50, actually. He is very much at risk. if he catches COVID-19, he is an extremely high risk case because he has, you know, he has compromised lungs from all those years, decades of smoking. he has blood pressure problems. He has, you know, various other, like slight arrhythmia of the heart. He has, you know, high cholesterol, which actually isn't a medical condition per se. It's, that's a different story. He has all these other risk factors. So he is at risk. I'm not saying this without empathy and without concern for people that I know who would be at great risk. But I'm saying this from the position of somebody who's seen these models and who's seen when they fail and when they break. Don't trust them because they're not worthy of trust. Don't trust the experts. They're not worthy of trust. They've violated our trust repeatedly. Don't trust the experts when they tell you that ventilating people is the only way to stop them from dying, because it's not. The data tells us otherwise. Don't trust the experts when they tell you that the economy is going to go through a very slow and painful recovery. Equally, don't trust the experts when they tell you the economy is going to bounce back, you know, back to what it was before. It's not. We know that. But don't trust the experts when they tell you that the economy is going to go through a long grinding phase of extremely low growth. Don't trust the experts when they tell you that unemployment is going to hit 30%. Don't trust the experts at all in anything. The odds are better than 90%, in my opinion. And by the way, don't trust me either. Don't just blindly follow what I'm telling you. Go and do your own homework. Go and do your own research. Try to understand the world as it works around you. Try to understand the world as it is, not as you want it to be, not as expert models predict it to be. Try to look at the world through skeptical eyes and look for the truth. Because experts don't do that. A lot of experts just don't do that. They come up with these wild-eyed, crazy theories, which we're expected to believe because they have PhD and DSC and, you know, MSc and all these other fancy titles behind their names. Look, I've been to two of the best schools in the world. I know that these educations are hugely overhyped and hugely overrated. Don't trust them when they tell you that this is the way things are going to be. It doesn't have to be that way. All you have to do is exercise a bit of that rarest of all commodities, common sense. All you have to do is try to prepare yourself for what's coming, and things will eventually be okay. Since it is Orthodox Easter, and since I believe very strongly in the Christian message of hope and faith, I'm going to end on, as usual, a hopeful note. Don't be afraid. God is with us. God walked among us through his Son 2,000 years ago. We have seen the worst of times. We have seen how bad things can get. We have not broken. We have not failed. God is with us and he will get us through this. And so will we get each other through this. Don't give up hope. Don't give up faith. Things will turn around. They're already starting to turn around. Things are already improving. The Kung Flu, as devastating as it is, and as much as the Chinese absolutely deserve to be held responsible for what they've done, and absolutely deserve to pay a price, being, you know, the low trust, irresponsible, unbelievably shifty people that they are, incredibly racist, and, you know, it sounds racist for me to say that, they are hugely racist people. I've met them, I've interacted with them, I've been among them. They have many splendid individual qualities, but they are some of the biggest racists you'll ever meet. They deserve to pay a price, and they will. One way or another, they're going to pay a terrible price for this. So, with that in mind, I'm going to wrap up here because we're coming up on the 1 hour mark. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 25, Expert Stupidity. I am Didact, and I will see you on the next one.